Daniel Wilson has a PhD in robotics, but he doesn't seem to trust them much. His first book was How to Survive a Robot Uprising, and his latest book is Robopocalypse, another book about robots turning on their masters and trying to destroy the human race. He lives right here in Portland. Daniel, thanks for coming in to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Your first book was kind of a tongue-in-cheek book with advice on how to survive the robot uprising. But I noticed that a lot of the stuff from there winds up in Robopocalypse, which is a more dramatic book, a thriller kind of thing. Things like you don't want to have long hair around the robots and get out of the cities because they can get around there really easy. So did someone figure that you needed to write the most plausible book about a robot uprising? Is that how that came about?
I think that it's sort of unavoidable that whatever I write is going to be fairly plausible just because I've spent so much of my life dealing with robots. So I wrote How to Survive a Robot Uprising when I was still in school studying robotics. And it was really funny, I thought, because robots are always evil. And I thought, okay,
and they
my
got the red eye
and I,
thing.
Yeah,
going.
And they have the red eyes and the buzzsaw hands and the pinchers. And I thought, well, I'm just going to ask all my colleagues and everybody, all these roboticists that are around me every day, you know, how to do that. Like, what would they do if your robot attacked you? What would you do? And so that was fun and funny. But over the years, you know, that was about 6 years ago. I had accumulated all of these stories and these scenarios of just really cool situations. I mean, I think they're cool. They're violent and scary. But finally, I had to get them all out in fictional form.
Yeah. I saw a talk that you had given somewhere, and you were talking about asking your colleagues, you know, what would they do to run away from the robots? And one of them said, I'd walk upstairs. I can't get that thing to walk upstairs.
Yeah, I'd go up one stair. I mean, well, yeah, that's true. I mean, that's typically the situation. I mean, I don't really think robots are dangerous, and I'm not afraid of them. I think they're great. I love thinking about them, and I think they're really, on some level, the pinnacle of human technology. I mean, they are the most complicated tools that we've ever built. But, you know, we definitely depend on technology, and it's all around us, and it's really scary to contemplate what would happen if we didn't have our technology, or if all of our little devices decided that they didn't like us for some reason, and we actually went head-to-head.
The best reason that I saw for a robot uprising in your book was where Arcos, who is kind of the robot mastermind,
yeah.
says, you know, we need to preserve nature. And so we're going to, like, cull a bunch of the humans to preserve nature.
Well, it's really hard to write from the perspective of a robot in the first place. And then this is also a super intelligent robot. So you're thinking, you know, how do you write Sherlock Holmes? How do you write Hannibal Lecter? Someone who's a lot smarter than you are. And thinking about robots, you know, my feeling is if you're this intelligent, what you're really going to be interested in is knowledge. I mean, that's the main defining characteristic of this robot is that it's really, really smart. And what are smart people concerned with but knowledge? And so the first thing that Arcos figures out is that if you take a really simple life form, just a bug or a piece of bacteria, and you look at how much information and knowledge is stored in there, just locked in the DNA and all of these complex patterns that make up life, you know, that's where the information is at. And then you have this whole universe filled with rocks smashing against each other. And although that's very interesting, there's a lot to learn, you know, a meteor or a rock or a sun or anything, it just doesn't compare to the complexity of life. And so, yeah, Arcos, one of his many goals is to sort of slow down, to remove the human footprint from nature in order to study a diverse set of life forms.
I would think that you're going to get some humans who are actually going to side with the robots on that argument.
Yeah, but not when they're running for their lives. And I mean, that's a lot of what the book is about. It's about pushing my characters all the way up against the wall to where and seeing what they'll do to survive, and not just to survive themselves in a selfish way, but what do you do when you're separated from your kids and something like this happens? What links will you go to get your kids? I mean, will you risk your life for your brother, for your son, for somebody you just met? And that's what's really interesting is this is human beings against the other. So I think, you know, I have an optimistic viewpoint on humanity. I think we're fundamentally good. And what happens in the book is that you see for the first time, it's all the humans, despite whatever differences they have, are pretty much on the same team because, you know, they're fighting something that's completely inhuman.
Well, the other thing that's really nice about it is you have some characters who are start out as being kind of these antisocial people, and when pushed up against the wall, they rise to the occasion and they put themselves out for the greater good. And that was, you have to be an optimist.
Well, I mean, yeah, when you see society and people are occupying various niches in society, and some people are, they fall into sort of a parasitic niche where they take advantage of other people. And that's, you know, fine. I mean, that's unavoidable and it's natural. But when that kind of person gets into a situation where they can't keep taking advantage of other people because the other people are being killed and are running and are in trouble, then a person like that really realizes that they have a duty to humanity. And at least in the case of what I wrote, that character that you're talking about really makes a transition and steps up and matures and becomes ready to sacrifice everything for its fellow humans.
And you pull it off because he's a believable character and his change is believable. Now, everybody who talks to you about this book has got to mention the fact that Steven Spielberg is already making the movie.
Yeah, it's interesting how that those two, the book and that movie, have become really inseparable. I mean, it's people are reading the book with that in mind, which is not, I don't know if that's really an ideal situation. I mean, I love, obviously, that Spielberg, of all people, you know, is the master himself is doing this, you know.
I really hope, you've got that one scene where the robots create a robot that's like a biology professor or something, and it's studying all the bugs, and your descriptions of it are just wonderful, and I hope he does justice to that robot.
Yeah, that's something I really like, is that instead of seeing all these death machines and monster robots falling out of the sky and scooping up humans, which I have, but you also see that they're building these towering skyscraper-like biological research stations, which are serving as, you know, hives for, there's birds nesting in these synthetic leaves and there's fish among, I mean, and they're just studying. And then at the top of it is just a big microwave radio dish that's just shooting billions and billions of gigabytes of data, you know, to the central station. And I love that it's a very lush apocalypse because it's not Mad Max. It's not like there's nuclear weapons being deployed. And also you need to explain that because whenever you see these movies, you know, other movies about robot uprisings, you think, neutron bombs. Just detonate a bunch of neutron bombs. It'll kill all the people. And then whatever you want to do, you can get back to it, Mr. Robot. But in this case, they want to preserve nature and they want to preserve all the animals. And so they're really specifically trying to root us out.
Right. It's kind of like the Chernobyl exclusion zone. All the people go away and the people die, but the animals thrive.
Yeah. But it's also worth mentioning that the robot's not 100% consumed with killing all people. It's very interested in people and it's interested in, you know, it's an adversarial relationship in that it's destroyed our civilizations all over the world. But it's not trying to kill every single human.
No, you get the feeling that he'll keep a few in zoos.
Well, or just the ones that are crafty and are just out loose. I mean, a lot of interesting stuff is happening. And, you know, I start out with a very familiar story. The book is called Robopocalypse. I mean, come on.
Right.
What do you think that's about? But then I'm aware of the landscape of all. I love reading. I mean, I've always loved reading science fiction about this stuff. So, you know, I'm aware of what's been done already. And I really tried to take it into a unique direction, and a direction that I thought was, this will sound funny, but respectful to the robots, because I really do think a super intelligent robot is its own thing. It would be its own life form, and it wouldn't necessarily be defined In relation to human beings.
Right. This is Between the Covers. I'm Marianne Barisonic, and my guest is Daniel Wilson. We're talking about his book, Robopocalypse. And now you're going to be talking tonight at Powell's, right?
Yeah, at 7:30 sharp. I'll be starting my book talk, and I'm looking forward to it.
And that's Powell's on Burnside.
Yeah, Powell's on Burnside at 7:30.
I hope the other thing that I hope that Spielberg does is has somebody reading How to Survive a Robot Uprising in the movie, because that would be great.
You know, it's going to be a pretty serious movie. And you know, I was very specific. I did not take the exact survival scenarios from How to Survive a Robot Uprising and put them in Robopocalypse.
But it would help somebody.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, How to Survive a Robot Uprising mostly teaches you a lot about robots and robotics and what the challenges are. And it does it in a fun way. But, you know, this book is really gritty. It's really realistic. The people don't always react, you know, the way they absolutely should. They don't always know. They all have different perspectives. There's a lot of different characters, and they have different cultural perspectives. There's a character in Japan. There's a soldier in Afghanistan. There's a hacker in the UK.
I have never seen a Native American sovereign nation be part of the resistance for a robot uprising. That was genius.
That is one of my favorite parts of this. So I grew up in Oklahoma, although I moved to Portland 6 years ago, and I'm here for good. I'm not going anywhere. My daughter is from Portland. But I grew up in Oklahoma, and I'm part Cherokee, just everybody there is, pretty much. It's not a big deal. But I did grow up inside the Cherokee Nation, within the boundaries of it. And there are sovereign, out here, everywhere, there are sovereign Native American governments that coexist with the United States of America. And you imagine that when everything hits the fan, the United States government is going to be the first thing to crumble because it's so big. And you'll see that these smaller sovereign governments, you know, I think that it's very likely that they would hold together in the face of a bigger crisis like this.
I also had the feeling that the Native Americans, they've already been through one invasion where people were trying to wipe them out completely. So they've kind of been through this before.
Well, I really wanted to use that contrast right at the beginning, because there's a part very early on where all the Native Americans that are Osage have naturally gone back to this place where they go every year, and it's their spiritual home, and it's also where their government seat is at. And so they all go back there, and they're all safe, because when this happens, robots don't come from outer space. It's all the technology in our lives, and where they all retreat to is a place that doesn't have a lot of technology, you know. So they're safe for the time being, and the first decision they have to make is, do we let others come in here, other humans? And I love it, because they almost immediately decide we're all human beings, and this is not about what color we are or any of that. And they open with open arms. They welcome everybody in, no matter what their race.
And the robots kind of start manipulating human beings by adding robotic appendages to them. And to their credit, the human resistance decides that they'll accept the hybrid people.
I wanted to push this theme as far as I could take it. So the very first thing that happens is humans realize, okay, religion, language, where you're from, what color you are, none of that matters, because we're all in this together. And then I thought, well, let's take it a step further. What if one of the humans starts getting has like a robotic eyes or robotic arms, something like that, where the machines are actually operating on the people? Would you accept somebody who is, you know, half robotic? And then I went all the way. What if there was a sentient robot that was willing to fight with you against the bad guys? And you've seen these robots do horrible things to your friends and family. They've destroyed, you know, our world. When your back is against the wall and it's about survival, will you fight alongside someone who was your enemy? And you know what? I think we will do anything to survive. And I love that about humankind.
Well, and these robots that join the human resistance, they're as much interested in their own freedom as the human beings are, because they're saying, okay, there's this mastermind up there, and it may be a robot, but I don't want it telling me what to do.
Yeah, I think that that's liberty being freedom, being able to choose your own actions, is I think the basis of being a living creature. And what I was really playing with was, what's the difference between a human and a person? Because a human is clearly somebody with DNA and it's a human being and all that. But what about a person who deserves rights, who deserves moral treatment? Can a robot ever be a person? Can we ever live side by side in a society with another intelligent species? And all of us have have a personhood about us, where we're all equal under the law and we have similar rights. And so, and what would it take for a robot to reach that point? I think if you look back and you look at how human beings have given each other personhood and human rights.
There was a long time where there's various classes of people that were not considered people.
Yeah. And how have people gotten rights traditionally? I mean, I think either they fight for them. There's a revolution and they say, we're not going to take it. We have to have our rights. And that's happening right now. It's always happening. And then there's another way where you show your indispensable worth. And I think that, for instance, in the United States in World War I, when women started building war machines and they proved to be crucial to the war effort. And then afterwards, they got the right to vote.
They decided we'd be people.
Yeah.
Wow.
Hey, why don't we let them vote? we depend on them. Without them, we would have all been in trouble. Why don't we go ahead and let them vote and actually make them part of our society? So it's interesting to me.
Now, there's a lot of horrendous robotic weapons that evolve in this book. I think the pluggers was the one that just kind of gave me the willies. And this is one where if you get a slug of this, like in your leg or your arm, it puts out these little creatures that then go up into your heart and explode.
Yeah, they burrow through you.
Yeah.
Not fun.
No, it sounds awful. But, we have a lot of real life awful robot weaponry. I mean, just the drones kind of really weird me out, this death from above from these inhuman machines. Do you have any insight into what's on the drawing books as far as
you can just look at the way things are going. People used to stab each other to death face to face, and you could say that's the most humane way to kill each other. Because you're talking about drones being you're shooting people from far away, and there's not even a person there. Well, think about whenever you upgrade to a bow and arrow, and then a gun, and you're getting further and further away from your adversary. People are further and further apart. And so, there's a really great book called Wired for War by Peter Singer that's all about this and looking at the future. I think that war really drives the development of technology, like it or not, and that, robots will continue to play a role. Really, to look at it from a general perspective.
This is why we fear robots.
No, I don't think it is. Those robots, drones and all that, sure, they're scary, but they're far away. You've never seen a drone, probably, except on TV. When's the last time you saw a drone flying over your house? But you think about this. Everybody you know and love is probably in your cell phone listed. Your cell phone is telling Steve Jobs where you're at all the time. That's scary because that's intimate. My cell phone is in my back pocket, 2 inches from, very intimate places. And, how much more intimate can you get, right?
If your cell phone turns against you, you're in trouble.
Well, you think about how much we trust technology. All of our data is in there. We have transportation, utilities, sewage, have communications, all this stuff. If it goes away, we're in trouble.
I think one word could sum up the problem with trusting technology, and that would be Fukushima.
Sometimes it gets out of control,
Well, we don't have any plan for dealing with the disasters that can be created by the technology that we have.
Well, human beings are always racing ahead, It's what we do. We build tools. I mean, that's what we do. That's pretty much, we can't help it. I have a 1-year-old daughter. This is just what we do. It's as natural as anything. And You know, we take the tools in our environment that we have whenever we grow up, and then we build on them. And as a result, we're on this train that's kind of just barreling ahead. And there are disasters along the way because we're going too fast and we can't stop. And I think that's great. I think that's an amazing, beautiful thing about humankind. The stakes are high, and they're getting bigger, and there will be disasters, and there will be terrible things that happen. But we're on our way somewhere. Things are getting better.
Boy, you really are an optimist.
Well, really, what are you going to do? Sit around and worry about a nuclear plant going to blow up and kill me? I mean, no, you got to live your life. Obviously, you have to do everything you can to ensure that you're going to prevent any sort of disaster. I mean, and that's all part of it. So, yeah, I'm not saying that we should recklessly rush ahead and just avoid and ignore, you know, all the ways that we could potentially really harm ourselves. I think that building technology to protect ourselves is just as important as building technology that, you know, provides power to people or propels us into outer space or whatever. But I really do respect and admire what human beings do, you know, naturally. And I really think it, to some extent, building technology and moving forward in the future with it is our destiny.
And Arcos, the mastermind, kind of admires that too. He says, well, humans are tool builders. We're the ultimate tools. Okay, now you're done.
Well, in some ways, Arcos is the ultimate Swiss Army knife. I mean, if you invent a tool that can invent any other tool to solve any problem in the future because he's so smart, then you've kind of, as a tool maker, you've really hit your zenith. I mean, you're never going to be able to build a tool better than the tool that would be built by Arcos.
Right, and so, that can learn and optimize
exactly.
And keep going.
Exactly.
So this is not your first book. And we were talking earlier about how it kind of like appears that you just wrote this one book and it was this tremendous bestseller and blah, blah, blah. Or it hasn't sold yet, but the movie's going to be made out.
Well, it's on sale right
now.
Yeah. And the book is doing really well and getting reviews, and I'm really happy about that. But yeah, I've been plugging away for a long time. I've written 6 other books, and I had one even that came out, a middle reader, my first fiction, A Boy and His Bot, and it came out this January, and nobody knew about it. It was sad. It's so sad. It came out, and it was really...
It sounds cute, A Boy and His Bot.
I love it. It was, you know, this is really... Robopocalypse is an outlet for a lot of really dangerous and thrilling and action-packed kind of scenarios, and the stuff that would be way too intense for 9 to 12-year-olds. But A Boy and His Bot is just all the fantastic Alice in Wonderland sort of creative stuff that I've accumulated over time, like robots that never stop being built, or gardens that have been sculpted by robot pruners and shearers and so forth, gardeners, you know, for thousands of years into, you know, just every single leaf sculpted. Just, you know, a lot of really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Fun stuff. The fun stuff.
And I think it's good for aspiring writers to know that even if the first book doesn't do that good, there might be something on the horizon.
As long as you can keep getting them to let you publish, you know, anything. So yeah, I've written a lot of articles. I will basically write anything for money. So yeah, it's been a long slog, but I'm really looking forward to Robopocalypse, seeing how it does.
And you've got a new book that you're working on.
Yeah. So I was able to sell my next book to my same editor and same publishing house, Doubleday. It's called Amp, and it doesn't have any robots in it.
Really?
Yes. I mean, I love technology. I love our relationship with technology, and I don't want to end up having to always have a robot. But what this is about is a near future human rights movement that's spurred by our technology transitions into our bodies. And so it's sort of like the day that you drop your daughter off to school and every kid in the class has a neural implant, and you realize, if I don't upgrade my kid, I'm going to be left behind, you know? And I think it really embodies this fear that we have of technology, where we feel like, man, if I don't keep up with this stuff, everybody else is going to leave me behind. I mean, if my kid doesn't have the newest laptop or, you know, whatever, then what's going to happen?
Right. And, you know, I wonder if what will really evolve is not that the robots become conscious, but that we have this merging of humans and technology where the line between what is a human being and what is a robot becomes so blurred that we can no longer see it.
Yeah, I think that's those sorts of things are absolutely coming. So robots have all these amazing abilities, you know, and we want them. And a lot of times...
I would love to have replacement parts, you know.
Well, it's already happened. I mean, and there are real sort of social issues. For instance, you think about kids who are born deaf and they get cochlear implants at some point. And then, you know, they can end up having trouble with the deaf community because upgrading your ears is an implicit admission that there's something wrong with being deaf, and other people think that that's not true. And so, you know, fitting into human society and figuring out how this technology is going to fit into our bodies and how we're all going to sort that out is really fascinating, you know, because we've had really similar situations in the past just with human rights movements at all. And you watch how our society, I think admirably, has slowly widened our definition of what a person is, and you know, so that more and more of us are invited to this party, you know, let's all be human beings.
It also, then we no longer have the question of at what point does the machine become self-aware or conscious? We imbue the machine with a consciousness by merging with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's heavy.
That's kind of scary, too.
Well, technology is always scary. You know, I mean, you think about our lives, and if you took someone from 100 years ago and transplanted them here, they'd have no idea how to function in our society. I mean, even if you just stop paying attention to new technology, you start to forget, you don't know how to pay for things. You know, you don't know how to communicate with people anymore.
Okay, and Daniel Wilson, your book is Robopocalypse. Thank you so much for coming in.
I obviously love to talk about robots. Thank you for having me.